Our condolences go out to the family and friends and the many people whose lives were touched by Curtis Hertel Sr., the former Speaker of the State House, died of natural causes yesterday at his home in Grosse Pointe at the age of 63. I regret not ever having Mr. Hertel on this program. I'm sure that would have been a very interesting and edifying segment. Curtis Hertel Jr., of course, our state senator here in East Lansing, describes his dad as a hero, a mentor, a best friend, and a fellow Tigers fan. Curtis Hertel Jr. saying to the Free Press, he was somebody who loved his family. His kids were always number one, no matter how important his job was. Leading off current state today, the Flint water crisis has dominated Michigan news for months, but even by that standard, the last 2 weeks have been eventful. A much-anticipated report from Governor Rick Snyder's Flint Water Advisory Task Force emphasized the role of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality in the failure. Still, the governor was not spared. Among other recommendations, it said the governor's office needs to include more people and more departments in the decision-making process. It also described the episode as an example of environmental injustice. Meanwhile, critics continue to call for Governor Snyder's resignation because of Flint. A short while ago, I spoke with Snyder administration spokesman Ari Adler. I first asked about the impact of FEMA's decision late last week to extend emergency status to Flint through August.
Well, certainly it's a positive that we were able to get the FEMA extension. That helps us with additional federal resources that we've been using. It takes us all the way through August. So hopefully we will be in a position then when things will be moving along better in Flint in terms of water delivery, and state resources will have to continue to fill in any gaps after that date.
What are those resources?
Well, primarily we're looking at bottled water, water filters, filter cartridge replacements, anything that we can do in terms of having a water available to people, but then also the secondary step of treating the pipes that are in the ground to make sure that they get that coating put back on that the corrosive water took away, which is what led to the lead leaching from the pipes, and then also looking at what we can do to replace pipes that need to be replaced in Flint.
Will it create a serious challenge come August when it expires?
Well, we're hopeful that it won't, that we're going to be in a good enough position at that point that it won't be a problem. But certainly, we are continuing to work with the federal government. The governor is working with members of Congress and the Senate in Washington to try to get additional funding. Primarily, there's a bill in there that could provide some funding to help us with replacement of lead service lines and pipes in Flint.
Last week, the governor attended the release of the findings of the Flint Water Task Force. Among those findings was that his staff relied on too few people in too few departments, and it recommended expanding the information flow to Mr. Snyder. Is that something the administration is receptive to and plans to implement?
Absolutely, and some of that is already underway. You know, the governor and others of us here in the administration now are saying that not enough questions were asked, or they weren't asked, and the answers weren't demanded correctly. And so that was a concern over, as you look back now, it's much easier to look back now and put all of the pieces of the puzzle together. But clearly what we have said here in the governor's office is that we are going to demand more answers from state departments when issues arise. And, we're going to question those answers that don't feel right for whatever reason. The governor has said he looks back every day and wonders what we could have done differently. And a lot of that has to do with, when you have the experts in the state departments telling you the water is fine, that it is safe, but you are continually hearing about the complaints. You have independent experts who are saying there are concerns. And unfortunately, it was proven that the state departments were wrong. The independent experts were correct, and we need to be more mindful of that moving forward.
The report also recommended a review of the state's emergency manager law because very important checks and balances, it claims anyway, are lost or in jeopardy. How does the governor feel about that recommendation, and is there a plan for a review?
We are going to be reviewing everything that came up in that Water Task Force report. The governor, within just 2 or 3 weeks of declaring the emergency and finding out exactly what was going on in Flint, getting things moving forward in terms of dealing with the immediate emergency and the crisis there in Flint, then started to look at what happened and how it happened. So he appointed this independent task force and that was very independent. And he said, you know, go find what happened to the best of your knowledge and your ability. And they did that. And so they came up with 44 total recommendations. We have about 25 of those that we've checked off, not as being done, but at least in process, the things we've already started to address. Among those is a look at the emergency manager law. In many, many cases in Michigan, that law has worked very well to get local control restored to a financially stable municipality or a school district. But in this case, there may have been some shortcomings in terms of how the water treatment plant was handled. You know, we had an emergency manager there in place. The emergency manager was in charge when the decision was made to switch to the Flint River for water source, but it fell upon the state as a responsibility. They did not require the city to use corrosion control, and that's what led to the problems with the pipes. But, you know, we also had a situation where soon after that switch had happened, the mayor was given direct control over the day-to-day operations of the water treatment plant. But there is some question about, you know, what were the checks and balances that were in place to make sure everyone was doing what they should have been doing. So the governor's open to reviewing that and seeing if there are improvements that can be made. He'll look at them.
We're talking with Ari Adler, spokesman for the administration of Governor Rick Snyder. Does the governor think he was treated fairly in Washington by the House Oversight Committee? It got very intense. He was subjected to some pretty harsh evaluations.
Well, the governor thought it was important to go there. That's why he volunteered to testify when they brought those committee hearings together. He thought it was important to go and answer the questions that certainly came from Congress, but were really being raised on behalf of the people of Flint and the people of Michigan. And from the beginning, he has apologized for what happened. He's taken responsibility. He believes that it was a failure of government at all levels, local, state, and federal. The only thing that he has control over is state government, so he's going to do everything he can to address the problems that caused what happened in Flint and caused this water crisis, to see what we can do to make sure that it never happens again.
But does he feel he was treated fairly?
That's really a personal question for him. I know, you know, watching the testimony and watching the questions that were raised, I mean, it is a very unusual format that they use there. I don't think most people watch that normally and realize how that is done. And really anybody who appears before those committees is put on the hot seat and is challenged. They don't always get an opportunity to respond to the questions that are asked, but you know, the governor was there to do what he could do and to share the information that he had, and I think he feels he had a chance to do that.
As fate would have it, the Detroit Free Press yesterday had three specific recommendations for the governor. Headline here, three things Snyder is still getting wrong about Flint. I'd like to ask you about those. One seems to echo a finding of the task force. They raised the issue of environmental injustice and urged the governor to acknowledge that Flint happened in part because it is a poor community and a community predominantly of people of color. What does the governor make of that charge?
Well, certainly there is no decision that was made specifically because of anyone's particular race or what the population of a city is. It was a mistake that was made at the city level to not include corrosion control when the Flint River was used for the water source. It was a failure at the state level because the DEQ did not follow up. They did not require the corrosion control. And then when questions were raised about that by independent water experts, instead of the DEQ reevaluating what it was doing, it simply went into a defensive posture and kept pushing people off. You have the EPA, and when their water expert found a red flag and said, what is going on in Flint, and started to issue memos about it, that those were pushed aside and everyone just sort of went back into the bureaucratic process. So, you know, it wasn't a situation where a decision was made because of race. What you are finding in situations like this, though, is that when you have a city that has socioeconomic challenges like Flint does with unemployment and education issues and everything else that's going on there, it can be much more difficult to recover. And that's why the governor's plan to restore the water in Flint is really about restoring Flint as a city. So we're looking at not just what's going on with water and water quality, but also looking at health care and education and jobs and economic development to help bring that city forward and help it move forward again.
The governor seemed to struggle a bit, though, responding to a question about this last point, environmental injustice and the importance of race in this whole thing. He said, quote, "I don't know if you can conclude it was a racial issue by any means, but I don't know." Is this an aspect of the Flint emergency that he has not considered closely?
I think he has considered everything closely. This has been very, very important to the governor to try to figure out what caused these problems and how to fix it. And so that is something that we are going to be reviewing everything that was involved. And you know, certainly this question of environmental justice has been raised here in Flint and across the country when things have happened. But you know, we're really looking at if there were something that occurred because Flint is a poorer city or is having economic problems or anything else that might be involved, what can we do to correct that? And that's really what we're looking for, is how do we look to the future? How do we make Flint come out of this better than it ever was? It's unfortunate and horrible that we have this crisis, that we have people who don't have water in their kitchens and their baths. I mean, it's one of those things you take it for granted. You just turn on the faucet and the water is there and it's expected to be safe. So we have to deal with that first, but then we have to figure out how do we help Flint recover as a whole and help the people move forward.
The paper also claims that Mr. Snyder still hasn't heard directly from the people of Flint, and it urges him to meet with them face-to-face to take the heat, in their words. First of all, are they right? Has the governor not met face-to-face, town hall style, with the people of Flint?
Well, the governor has had a number of teletown halls where calls are made and people can talk directly to the governor by the phone. It's a little easier. You can reach out to thousands of people at once who can talk to the governor directly or hear what's going on, hear answers from him and from people in the administration directly. So we've reached thousands and thousands of people in Flint doing it that way. There was at least one town hall one of the local TV stations put on that we had. Rich Baird, who's the director of our Mission Flint team, and Lieutenant Governor were there. When we are hearing from people constantly through a lot of sources, and the governor is meeting with people, including the mayor of Flint and a lot of opinion leaders in Flint. He's met with concerned pastors. He met with a lot of people. We have not had a direct town hall meeting. There is some question about, I would think, yes, it allows people to vent, but does it really get anything solved? And we would look at that and have to take that into consideration.
I'm thinking it might very well have some pretty powerful you make an understandable point. It may just be primarily about letting citizens vent, understandably, but I'm wondering if they don't have a point that there is some value here to meeting directly with citizens. Is this the kind of thing that you're revisiting or might revisit?
Well, I don't think anything has been dismissed by the governor. I mean, he's willing to look at whatever he can do to help Flint move forward. So certainly we're taking everything that's being suggested under advisement, and we'll have to look at what the governor's available for and what we can do to help get him in contact with people in Flint, to help get people to work together, to come together to solve this problem.
Finally, the paper says the governor should launch a legal defense fund to pay for representation in the court actions that have been filed. Instead, he's apparently pursuing publicly funded representation by private sector firms. Why not a legal defense fund?
Well, there's no sort of criminal activity that occurred, and that's generally when you would use a legal defense fund. The activities that happened, whether it was the governor or state, it was all done in the role of as public servant. I mean, it's much like the Attorney General's office, for example, represents state employees, those that it feels it has a conflict with. There are some folks, for example, from the DEQ that have private representation that is being paid for by the state. It is because the work that they were doing was in public service, and so the use of state dollars is considered appropriate for that.
According to an Epic MRA poll from last week, 41% of Michigan citizens think the governor should resign over his role in the water crisis. What is the governor's current thinking about that option?
The governor plans on staying put and solving this problem. He is not the type of person to walk away from a problem. I think people have seen that throughout his tenure, that he is going to tackle a problem and he's going to solve it by bringing people together, figuring out the best way forward through a problem. He's not concerned about blame. He's not concerned about credit. He hasn't been that way all the way through his administration. It's really about what is the problem that needs to be fixed. And, you know, he personally feels like the that I'm in charge of fixing the problem is the person who had to stand up and take responsibility for it. And while the governor did not personally make decisions about whether to treat the water for corrosion or not in Flint, people that worked for him throughout the bureaucracy of state government fall under his control. And so he has stood up and taken responsibility for it. And he is very passionate now about fixing this. And as the governor has said, you know, who has more passion about fixing the problem than the person who feels responsible for it? And so that's how he feels about it. He's here to stay, and he's here to solve it.
Ari Adler is a spokesman for the administration of Governor Rick Snyder. Ari, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, on March 28, 1941, a small army of construction workers began clearing a 5-square-mile patch of land near Ypsilanti. The Willow Run Bomber Plant was the largest aircraft manufacturing facility ever built. Now, 75 years later, Willow Run's proud legacy of innovation continues. We will talk with John Maddox, CEO of the American Center for Mobility, about plans to test connected vehicles at Willow Run. Jim Harrison, the Michigan-based writer renowned for his work in both fiction and poetry, has died at the age of 78. He was probably best known for Legends of the Fall, his book that became a hit movie starring Brad Pitt. Known as a rugged outdoorsman, Harrison was born in Grayling and grew up in Hazlet. The 1960s-era Michigan State University graduate was a collegiate contemporary of fellow writer Tom McWain. A few years ago, Harrison and McWain spoke at a Wharton Center program along with another great Michigan author, Richard Ford. The host of that program was historian and Lansing City Pulse writer Bill Castanier. Bill Castanier joins us now to remember Jim Harrison. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've mentioned Legends of the Fall. Tell us a bit more about Jim Harrison's other works. I mean, for people who might only know him for the movie, how does it fit in with all the rest of his output?
I think it's most noted because it was made into a movie. Other than that, there's many, many of his novels, novellas, and books of poetry that are better. But it caught the attention of the movie industry. But I think some of his most noted books are like Dalva, which he wrote in a woman's voice, which people don't know much about. His poetry books are all phenomenal, including his most recent. And then he wrote, one of my favorite books is The Raw and the Cooked, which is a collection of essays that ran in Esquire over a period of years. And I remember subscribing to Esquire for that particular reason, is to read his essays. And his essays on cooking were quite unusual because they might include something like how to make head cheese. You know, take one pig's head, boil for 24 hours. And I think his work, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, he's going to be considered one of the great American novelists like Faulkner.
You think his reputation will be enhanced after his death?
It always does with an author.
Do his works have Michigan settings?
Oh, absolutely. I would say the broad number of them do, the vast majority. One of his most famous collections is Brown Dog, which is quite an unusual character in literature. And Brown Dog almost all take place in Michigan. He loved Michigan. He lived here for quite some time. He grew up in Reed City, Hazlet, and then lived in Leelanau for maybe two decades before then sharing his time between Arizona and Montana.
What do we know? What did we learn through his work about his affection for the outdoors? Where did this come from?
Well, I think it came from his parent, his father, who was an outdoorsman. His father also worked for Michigan State University in the Extension Service. And Jim's love of the outdoors, I believe, started with gardening. I was with him several times in MSU gardens, and his affection for the earth, the plants, was amazing to see. He could sit there for hours upon hours in one of the MSU gardens and just think.
Which ones? Where did you spend time with him?
The one he liked the most is what is called the MSU Hidden Garden, the secret garden that was done by the radiologist.
Oh, Jim Pochin.
Yes, Pochin. Yeah, God, he loved Pochin's garden.
Well, that's an extraordinary spot.
It is, and it was quiet. There wasn't a lot of people there, but one of the reasons he liked gardens is after his father and his sister were killed in an auto accident by a drunk driver, he kind of immersed himself in MSU Gardens. That's where he sought solace. He said without it, he would have gone crazy.
You're going to read a Jim Harrison poem for us. Tell us about it.
Well, the poem I'm going to read is from a book, In Search of Small Gods. The poem is meaningful to me because when my mother died a few years ago, I called Jim and asked him, I asked permission if I could read this poem. I never did anything without asking him if I could use something in print or something like that, and he was always gracious. And the reason I wanted to read it, it'll become apparent at in the last sentence, is it because it confronts death. Mm-hmm. And he, in his last writings, he was writing very much about his own mortality. So this is called Larson's Holstein Bull. Death waits inside us for a door to open. Death is patient as a dead cat. Death is a doorknob made of flesh. Death is that angelic farm girl gored by the bull on her way home from school, crossing the pasture. For a shortcut, in the seventh grade, she couldn't read or write. She wasn't a virgin. She was simple-minded, we all said. It was May, a time of lilacs and shooting stars. She's lived in my memory for 60 years. Death steals everything except our stories. And for me, that was kind of his life in a nutshell. It was about he was an incredible storyteller. And when someone dies, we all sit around and tell the stories about their life. And I think that's what's going to happen in the next few weeks about Jim Harrison. There are some amazing stories about him.
Bill Castanier writes about books for the Lansing City Pulse. We're talking about Jim Harrison, the Michigan-based author and poet who died this weekend. What's your most memorable time you spent with him? How much time did you spend with him?
Well, I first met him at a bar in East Lansing. It was Beggar's Banquet. He liked bars. In 1973, and over a period of 20, 25 years, I'd run into him consistently, whether it was in Leelanau, at book readings. I'd make a point of going to his book readings. In Chicago, I went to a book reading because I just coincidentally was in the city at the same time, and a friend of his asked me out for dinner with him, and that sort of started our relationship, which he called me a pal, which to me was a very affectionate term. But after that, after we did the event at MSU, I always called him about every book. I called him on his birthday. We talked candidly about a lot of things, including the loss of what he thought would be the loss of his wife before he died, which he said was his greatest fear, and that happened 6 months ago.
Yeah. What was he like on a personal level? I mean, he has this rugged, no-nonsense kind of exterior, and indeed a lot of that is reflected in his writing. Was that consistent with him on a face-to-face basis?
I think not. I mean, you could see some of those influences in how he dealt with life, but he was the kindest, gentlest, smartest. He was beyond smart. I saw him when we were in the MSU Gardens, for example, stop and talk to a woman pulling weeds for like 20 minutes. Not many people would do that. They would just dismiss that person. Now, Jim was down to earth, literally and figuratively, and I think that wasn't often seen because he was caught up in being the macho hunter fisher. And that wasn't Jim, totally. Jim was kind, gentle, would do anything for anyone, and he was extremely loyal. I mean, he had two publishers, Grove Press, and then his publisher of his poetry books, Copper Canyon, that he stuck with his entire publishing career.
You mentioned his wife, who passed away about a year ago, or less than a year ago, Linda King Harrison. Do we know much about her impact on his work? Did she have any?
Oh, absolutely. He always said she did. She read everything, and also she was sort of his, not anchor, but she kept him on target. They were married more than 50 years, and for people who said he was a misogynist, you'd only have to know Linda to know that he wasn't. And he also had an assistant named Joyce who really for, I think, close to three decades did everything for him. What she enabled him to do was write rather than do stupid things.
How do you know how well he adapted to his life without his wife?
Poorly.
Okay.
Like I said, that was his greatest fear, that he would outlive her.
Yeah. Did you have much contact with him here since she died?
Not much, no. He went into somewhat hibernation. I know he finished two big books during that period. In fact, it was right before she died. It was the last time I talked with him.
He remained busy to the end, as you just alluded here, with two books coming out just this year. He was just interviewed by the New York Times a week or so ago, and he told them, quote, "I now find myself in an occasional state of surprise that I've made a living as a novelist for quite some time, the opposite of what I expected." Did he really not expect to make a living as a novelist?
I think in his early career, he certainly he didn't think he could ever make a living as a writer, period, of any kind, and he suffered depression during that period because of that. But good friends pulled him out of it. Tom McGuane got him to write Wolf. Absolutely.
This is so ironic, Bill, because Friday night is cable movie night at our house. Would you care to guess the movie that I pretty much out of the blue decided to watch on Friday night?
Missouri Breaks?
It was. That's relevant. I'm glad you brought that up. It was Wolf.
Wolf, okay.
It was Wolf. And I've always enjoyed the movie. It doesn't necessarily change your life, but I've always thought it was
movie.
A great movie. Jack Nicholson, Michelle Pfeiffer, and
and, you know, Jack Nicholson pulled him out when he was very desperate for money. He loaned him some money.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was on the set of Missouri Breaks, I believe. That's when Nicholson was introduced to Jim by Tom McGuane, and Nicholson liked his writing. And he said, "Here's some money. Keep writing." Because Jim was ready to go and teach, which to him would have been deadly. And that was kind of his relationship with Nicholson, and it pulled him into the Hollywood set where he made a lot of money screenwriting for a lot of things that were never produced.
Tell us, now, explain the relevance of the Missouri Breaks here, though, too, because you alluded to that.
Well, Tom McGuane, at a point, is still an incredible writer. He's pretty much not writing as much as he used to. He's enjoying himself in Montana also and his horse farm. But McGuane and Harrison were a wild bunch, let's just put it that way, when they got together. And he invited him to the set of Missouri Breaks, which is a campy Western, frankly. And it was written as a script first and then a paperback book. And Tom, who was always Jim's friend in college, introduced him to Nicholson. And that set off a lifetime, not a lifetime, but many years of friendship with Nicholson, who opened up many doors for him, and also did for Tom McGuane.
And, of course, the movie created quite a stir because it united Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando in what became a mediocre, at best, movie.
It could have been a good movie. It's too bad because it had incredible stars in it.
Do we know anything about services for Jim?
Nothing yet, no. Okay. My guess is it'll be something very quiet for his two daughters and their families. And the very closest friends, if any, that he would have a service for. Jim didn't really believe in that. Mm.
Bill Castanier writes about books for the Lansing City Pulse. Thanks for this look at the remarkable life and literary career of Jim Harrison. Jim Harrison, the noted author and poet who died this weekend at the age of 78 at his winter home in Arizona. Thanks again. Coming up on Current State, Free Press sports writer and Current State contributor Joe Rexrode is packing up and heading to Nashville, where he'll be following the sports scene there. He'll join us and look back on the highs and lows of the many MSU and other Michigan sports moments he's covered over the years. That and more after the break. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Many thanks for joining us here on Monday, the 28th of the month. 75 years ago today, March 28th, 1941, heavy equipment crews started clearing a huge swath of land near Ypsilanti. With a deadly air war raging in Europe, the U.S. began work on a massive bomber plant that came to be known as Willow Run. It was the largest aircraft manufacturing facility ever built.
Thousands of skilled workers were employed, pouring 100,000 yards of concrete, erecting 38,000 tons of structural steel, setting 10 million bricks, fitting miles of piping, and running more miles of electric cable to operate the thousands of machines that were to be installed in this truly giant structure.
Willow Run churned out one B-24 bomber an hour. At its peak, it employed 42,000 people, one-third of them women. Now, Willow Run is being repurposed for a new mission. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now to explain. Kevin, what could possibly carry on the Willow Run legacy?
Mark, the very thing that built this state, cars. Driverless cars and connected vehicle technology is really taking off, especially in the Ann Arbor area. Last week, the state of Michigan awarded some seed money to the American Center for Mobility, which will test those vehicles at Willow Run. Given this recent news and the anniversary of the plant's beginnings, as you talked about, I thought I would take a look at Willow Run then and now. The last time I visited the site, I spoke with Randy Houghton with the Yankee Air Museum, and we climbed aboard a huge but very cramped vintage bomber plane.
We're coming back to the back door here where the crew would enter the airplane, unlike the Hollywood movie where they chin themselves on the nose turret and pull themselves in. And we're looking in the back here. You can see the waist gunner positions, the ball turret position, and you can see the Spartan complex that these crew members lived in. There was no heat in this airplane. They'd go to 30,000 feet where the temperature would be a minus 70 degrees with wind whipping through the airplane. And they had to wear electric underwear. That's how they kept themselves warm. And throughout the airplane, you'll find these outlets with rheostats by them where guys could plug their underwear in and adjust the temperature so they could survive in that harsh environment. Frostbite was the most common injury on this airplane. This is for 19-year-old boys who are 135 pounds and as limber as a piece of wet spaghetti. But you kind of go down the steps, sit on the seat, and then get on your hands and knees, and you crawl forward.
All of this at 28,000 feet.
Yeah. With seven layers of clothing on. And a walk-around bottle, because you got to be hooked up to oxygen the whole time. You'll pass out in a minute if you're not hooked up to the oxygen. When the first units went over to Europe, they had never even flown at altitude. Curtis LeMay, one of the first bomber groups to go over there, his guys had no experience at high altitude when they were going over there. So this was all a learning experience to make these bombers effective.
Now, in a new century, a new high-tech fleet will soon patrol the old runways of Willow Run. The historic aircraft plant once operated by Henry Ford is going back to its automotive roots. Willow Run will be the new home of the American Center for Mobility. John Maddox is its CEO.
We're very honored to be following up 75 years later with working on a new innovation, a new technology of automated vehicles and connected vehicles.
Tell me something about the vision of the American Center for Mobility. What's the underlying goal of this new facility?
I say there are two underlying goals with this new facility. One of them is to accelerate the deployment of these connected and automated vehicle technologies because they potentially will bring us great value in our transportation system. If you think about our system today, it's worked for about the last 100 years, and it's served us pretty well. But we have imperfections, things like congestion, traffic jam, crashes, wasted energy. These new technologies might help us envision a new transportation system for the next 100 years, one with far fewer crashes, with far less congestion, far less wasted energy, and perhaps maybe even more importantly, also with freeing up a little bit of our time during our morning commute. The other underlying, call it value proposition, is to do that, many companies, both in the automotive and the technology worlds, need a place where they can come and really test their vehicles through those validation phases in a safe manner without doing it on public streets, at least in addition to doing it on public streets. So the facility will serve those companies and those industries and those government entities that are working on this future transportation system.
And what makes the Willow Run complex an ideal location for this type of testing? How do the stars align so that this can happen?
I think the most important thing about the location is the fact that it's in the heart of the auto industry, Southeast Michigan particularly, but Michigan in general. There's no option like it in the world of activity around connected and automated vehicles, particularly around the validation and verification of those. The other reason that the stars align here at Willow Run is that, again, this facility has this history of innovation. It also has an existing well-built and well-constructed infrastructure. For example, it's quite a large site. It's got roughly about 330-some acres, a large portion of which is a huge concrete slab that the plant was sitting on for the last 75 years. We can use that concrete slab as the foundation, if you will, for the new road surfaces we put on top of it. In addition, the site is served by very large roadways with highway-like on-ramps and off-ramps and overpasses that we can utilize for the site. If we had to go and build those new, it would double, triple, even quadruple the cost of such a facility. But the fact is, it's already built here in Michigan and is right now sitting fallow, so we're going to take advantage of that.
We're talking with John Maddox, who is the newly named CEO of the brand new American Center for Mobility, which will be located at the Willow Run site near Ypsilanti. This will be a place for driverless and connected vehicle technology. Last Tuesday, a key part of this whole process fell into place. The Michigan Strategic Fund Board authorized a $3 million grant for the center. That's only part of the funding you'll need. I understand there's another $17 million that will be requested. What's the $3 million for?
You could look at it as our seed funding. With that, we will get the design and the acquisition of the land underway. Right now, the land is owned by another entity, and we're looking at, the state is looking at doing its due diligence to work towards the purchase of the property that we will build the site on.
What is driving driverless vehicles? Are we moving away from, you know, the gee whiz factor? We have the ability, let's tinker with this. Are we moving toward a situation where there's a recognized need to have this type of technology on our highways?
I think that we are. The product development process is happening very, very rapidly with automated and connected vehicles moving towards driverless. We have a small scale version of this operating in Ann Arbor now, on the campus of University of Michigan. We call it M-City. We opened M-City last July 2015, and it has been under very high demand since then. So we know firsthand the some of the needs for the development community in testing and evaluating their potential products, their future products. But we also know that M-City doesn't have all of the scenarios, is not big enough to accommodate all of the testing that needs to go on. So we're very confident that building Willow Run, we will be able to serve a much larger portion of those testing needs here in Michigan.
So here's the question that I really want to ask you, Mr. Maddox, and I imagine you've probably heard it before. A computer knows how to respond to a scenario. Its programming says, oh, okay, I've seen this happening in my programming. I've seen what an icy road is all about. I'll respond like this. But a computer does not make decisions. A computer does not have instinct like a human driver. A human driver might be in a situation where they're sliding or something and they're forced to choose, well, do I hit this tree or this mailbox or this person? A human being has to make a value judgment. What do you say about that?
I think that you've hit on a very difficult task for any company or any individual or organization that is creating these products. We as humans are actually pretty good drivers. We get a bad rap. You know, people think, and it is correct that we do, human error contributes to 90%+ of the crashes in the country. However, on the other hand, we drive on average 100 million miles in between fatal crashes. So humans are actually pretty good. And we're also, as you allude to, pretty good about making snap decisions in very unusual situations. We get trained, that's part of our driver education, from a very young age to identify, hey, this doesn't look quite right. And we get trained in how to react to emergency situations, and we're generally pretty good at it. So I don't have a silver bullet answer for you on how automated vehicles will be trained to make value judgment. I think perhaps a way forward is to think about how humans react in those situations and have the human programmer if you will, make a decision for that robot and program that decision in. But by no means is that an easy approach. It's not a simple answer, and there's a lot of work to be done still for that.
So that tells me then that the computer is not going to supersede the human being anytime soon.
I think that it's fair to say that the majority of automated vehicle decision-making will be programmed into the computer ahead of time by a human, at least right now. The artificial intelligence piece, the machine learning piece, that's still many, many years off.
So what's your timetable now? What's next in the works for the American Center for Mobility? When can we expect to see the next chapter being written?
Well, we are, of course, quite busy this year. I'll call it kind of a planning year. We're shooting for some sort of groundbreaking in 2017.
John Maddox is the CEO of the American Center for Mobility, which is to be situated at the Willow Run Complex near Ypsilanti. Again, that's the historic site of World War II bomber aircraft production. Mr. Maddox, thank you so much, and best of luck with this new endeavor. It sounds exciting.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, twice daily every weekday at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m., every weekday at noon on AM 870, and always at WKAR.org. From national championships to first-round eliminations, from Rose Bowl triumphs to stunning gridiron losses, they are all part of the Spartan saga. But for nearly two decades, a constant has been sports writer Joe Rexroad on the sidelines covering the story for Michigan sports fans. Joe will be leaving Michigan soon to accept a position with the Nashville Tennessean starting in April. We wish him well, and we want to send him off this morning. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am well. We hope you are the same. Remind us how long you've been covering MSU sports.
Yeah, well, I've been on the beat as a beat writer going back to 2003 at the Lansing State Journal. But before that, I covered, late 90s for the state news and then also for the Lansing State Journal as a sort of an intern / stringer. I was lucky enough to be able to cover the 2000 National Championship in that role. So I guess if you go by season, I think it's 16 of the past 18 in basketball and 15 of the past 18 in football.
Well, the Lansing area would seem to be in your DNA here. Talk to us about what's luring you to Nashville.
Yeah, it is, and it's been very difficult, but really the job was very appealing. I mean, it's a columnist job, which is very different from a beat writer job. So this will be, more writing opinion about various teams in the area. And Nashville is appealing as well. My older sister lives there. We're very familiar with it. We've visited it many times. So I started talking to them a couple months ago. And even when that started, I didn't really think of it that seriously. But then I went down and interviewed and everything. And it ended up being really tough. It was right before Michigan State played at Rutgers. I had to decide that day, and I must have made 10 calls to my wife in a matter of, 8 minutes before finally figuring it out. But I finally did decide to take that job.
Has it been hard, Joe Rexroad, to stifle the columnist's impulse over the years to share opinions in your stories?
Well, that's the thing. Even for a few years at the Lansing State Journal, when we didn't have a columnist, I kind of did both roles, and that's sort of how things in this industry have gone, and just fewer jobs and more people doing multiple things. And with the blog, there was sort of that ability to give opinion and have a voice. So I feel like I've been able to do that, but there's still a big difference between strictly doing that and really being able to focus on that aspect of it versus, if you're a beat writer, of course, if there's a recruit at any point in the middle of the night, you're going to write about it. If there's anything that happens, you're responsible for it. So that's one big difference.
But you will be you'll be allowing a side of your creativity to come out that you've kind of had to put on the back burner more in the past, and you're kind of switching front and back burners, if I'm hearing you correctly. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, exactly. I mean, now the focal point will be, opinion and yeah, I think you're right, creativity and variety as well. I think a lot of it down there will be a lot of Tennessee Titans. Obviously, they're very popular NFL team, but there's an NHL team, the Nashville Predators, and various colleges too. Of course, right now Vanderbilt is going through a coaching search, so I'm kind of thinking of that a little bit here as I wrap up on the free press.
Mm. In a couple of recent columns, you assembled with an assist, I think, from your old employer, the Lansing State Journal. You assembled some of the most memorable MSU football and basketball moments, and I not surprisingly, I see MSU's 2000 National Basketball Championship was at the top of the list of memorable hoops moments. What detail of that do you remember most vividly?
Well, you always think from the writer's perspective. So one thing I remember is that I was the third person at the Lansing State Journal. We had a beat writer, beat writer Larry Lades, columnist Jack Ebling. And even as the third person, I was, basically center court front row for that. And now at those events, it's very, very different. There are very, very few good press seats. But on the court, certainly I remember, I remember when, my team Cleves went down with the ankle and walking over to the baseline and kind of, I got up from my seat and went to take a closer look. And I said to myself, okay, well, he's done for the game. It's very obvious he's done.
Right.
There's no way he's coming back. And then, of course, you're sitting there on press row and the big screen shows him walking through the hallway, and all of a sudden all the Michigan State fans, it really was probably like a boxer entering the ring or like, Clyde Frazier for the New York Knicks in 1970 or whatever it was, something like that. So that one stands out for sure. And, even the games before it at the Palace against Syracuse and Iowa State, they were such dramatic games, and that building was so loud. Once the Michigan State made its comebacks in those games, and the Michigan State fans, certainly took up most of that building. One of the loudest buildings I've ever heard.
What about football, Joe? Lots to choose from just from the past several years. You've kind of presided over the renaissance of MSU football in after a fashion. What comes to mind?
Right, and of course, it's been a lot of successful football, a lot of wins, championships. But, I just did this weekend. I'm trying to do a different top 10 list every day on the blog at freep.com and lsj.com to just recap some things. Today, I think I'm going to do my top 10 food items from the Big Ten. So, I'm all over the place. But the finishes are amazing when you think about trying to do 10 of them, a top 10. And, just think about last year alone. The Michigan game, is going to be number one for a long time in terms of wild finishes. But Ohio State and Nebraska from last year, Little Giants against Notre Dame, the Hail Mary against Wisconsin, the Cotton Bowl, the Rose Bowl. There's so many games that were just incredible finishes. And for the most part, Michigan State has been able to win most of those games. And so that alone, just some of the plays that will be remembered probably forever by Michigan State fans, all happening in the past, 6-7 years.
Are you gonna pro sports stories may not be quite as plentiful in Tennessee as here in Michigan. There's no pro baseball team in Tennessee, if I remember correctly, but there is an NFL and an NBA team. If I've still got the franchises right in my memory. Does the sports landscape in Tennessee appeal to you?
Yeah, well, I will say I love colleges, and I love basketball. And that was one thing I looked at and said, gosh, I'm really going to miss. I especially, my favorite thing of this job is basketball. And even just covering practices and watching Michigan State practice is so fun, and it's so interesting. So, I'm probably going to be bothering Vanderbilt a bit. When I went down to St. Louis, Middle Tennessee beats Michigan State, and my new employer says, "Hey, can you write a column for us?"
Yeah.
So there's some things like that. But you're right. It's a lot more pro stuff, the Titans and Predators, and I'll have to adjust to that. But I like the NFL as well. So, I mean, I think it'll be interesting. Marcus Mariota is a young quarterback, and maybe that's a franchise that can turn things around, and it'll be interesting to chronicle that.
Joe, please accept our thanks for making yourself available as often as you have here on Current State. You've been a part of our success. We want to wish you luck, and I want to urge you not to change your cell phone number just in case MSU faces Tennessee in a bowl game sometime soon.
I want you to consider me your SEC correspondent. Thanks so much to you and Peter Worf and everyone over there. You guys are great. I really appreciate it.
Well, we couldn't be happier for your move. It's obvious you're excited about it. We'll stay in touch, and we'll follow you on social media.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Mark.
Joe Rex Rode off to the Nashville Tennessean soon after many years here covering Lansing area sports, particularly MSU football and basketball. Tomorrow on Current State, the Cold War is melting in the tropics. President Obama's state visit to Cuba last week was the first for a U.S. president since Calvin Coolidge. As Cuba opens its doors to the world, we'll talk with an MSU professor who's an expert on that island nation, as well as one of her students who recently returned from his own trip. Plus, we'll find out from the lead actress of the Riverwalk Theater's new production, Wait Until Dark, why she has bruises on her shins. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Peter Worf is our executive producer. Kevin Lavery directed today. Thanks to Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. We hope to see you Tuesday. It's Current State.